for Lewis and Clark, and really almost all explorers up until at least like the last 100 years, and probably even more recently than that, like a huge part of the exploration was really like to bring humans and to sort of conquer these places, right? I mean, they're trying to figure out how they can like push settlements further west, or, you know, develop trade routes, and, you know, sort of, and so, you know, now we go to these wild places to really try to help people appreciate them and conserve the remaining islands of wilderness that we have.
Welcome back to the Byland Podcast. My name is Emery, and this is episode 61, and my guests today are Dave and Amy Freeman. I asked Dave and Amy to come on the podcast after a recent social media post regarding some threats to the Boundary Waters, which is a wilderness area in northern Minnesota, which many have come to love and adore. In fact, Dave and Amy actually spent an entire year living in the Boundary Waters and wrote a book about it, so we talk about that, their adventures leading up to that, and specifically in the latter half of the episode, we talk about the threats to the Boundary Waters and what we can do to help mitigate those threats. So, yeah, if you're into conservation, adventuring, and just hearing what people are up to in the wilderness, this is the episode for you. And I will include links in the show notes to all of those various things that they're up to and what we can do. So if you want to take some actions, just scroll down and click on those hyperlinks, and you'll be good to go. So without further ado, episode 61 with Dave and Amy Freeman. Please enjoy. Dave, Amy, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
You guys have, I was mentioning before we started recording that I've been following you for a long time, actually. And it's finally nice to kind of meet you virtually over the phone and kind of get to know you guys and what you guys are up to. So I'm personally really excited about this one.
Well, yeah, thanks for having us on.
Do you guys want to do an introduction to what you're up to, what you guys are all about? Feel free to, the floor is yours. This is your podcast. So, kind of introduce yourselves and what you guys are up to.
Sure. So we live in northern Minnesota, sort of smushed between the Canadian border and Lake Superior, in this big wild area called the Boundary Waters. It's just a maze of lakes and rivers. And so we have worked up there as dog sledding guides in the winter and canoeing guides in the summer for a long time. So really our bread and butter is, you know, taking people out into the wilderness and introducing them to wild places and, you know, teaching them how to camp and paddle and portage, which is basically like backpacking short distances where you carry everything, including your canoes, on these hiking trails from one lake to the next. So that's, you know, that's sort of our day job, I guess. And then more recently, we've really become interested in protecting the Boundary Waters, because after many years of just sort of appreciating the place, we found out about a series of copper mines that are being proposed right on the edge of the wilderness. Any water that's polluted from these mines would flow directly north into the wilderness. And we sort of, the more we learn, the more concerned we have become. And so we've really become strong advocates for protecting the Boundary Waters from these copper mines. And we're working closely with a nonprofit organization called Save the Boundary Waters. And you can learn more at savetheboundarywaters.org.
So we've done a variety of things with the campaign to save the Boundary Waters. And the biggest thing that we have done so far is we spent a whole year in the Boundary Waters Canoe Wilderness. It's the largest wilderness area east of the Rockies and north of the Everglades, so over 1 million acres.
Jeez.
And we didn't leave. We didn't go in a building. We didn't take a shower. We didn't flip a light switch or cross a road for 366 days.
It was a leap year, so we got an extra day.
Yeah. And we had volunteers. We had over 300 volunteers bring supplies into us. They brought our canoe out after the lakes froze in the fall and brought sled dogs in that would spend the winter with us. And, you know, really the whole reason for being out there was just to bear witness to this place. It's a national treasure. It's like a Yellowstone or Yosemite. It's our nation's most popular wilderness. More people visit it than any of the other 700 plus federally designated wilderness areas in the country. People flock there from all over. And, you know, the water is so clean in these lakes. You can just dip your cup right in the lakes and drink the water right out of the lakes.
What?
Wow. It's a place. Wolves and moose and bear and lynx and loons and great fishing. It's anyone that loves the outdoors, it's a place that you should put on your bucket list to visit. There are several hundred miles of hiking and backpacking trails that cut through the wilderness, but personally, I think that seeing it by, you know, traveling by canoe is really the way to see it, because you paddle across a lake and then you portage, you basically hike from one lake to the next. It could be 100 yards, it could be a mile and a half, but, you know, put your canoe back in the water and then you paddle on, and it's just this maze, you know, in that you visited over 500 different named lakes, rivers, and streams, and, you know, camped in 120 different places, and it's just a vast wilderness, truly vast, and it's really like no other place on earth. So we just wanted to try and raise awareness about this place, this special place that is really being threatened by a series of copper mines. A copper mine has never been built anywhere in the world without causing significant ground or surface water pollution. And the first mine that they want to build, this Chilean mining company called Antofagasta wants to build this mine that's literally underneath and alongside a lake, and less than a mile and a half from the edge of the wilderness, and the water from, it's called the Kushiri River, but it looks like a big lake. Basically, the water just flows north directly into the wilderness area. So any pollution would flow right into the wilderness. And so it really is putting at risk something that is truly special. And so, you know, we thought, well, we're not lawyers, we're not independently wealthy, we're not scientists. but we thought we're good at traveling in the wilderness, so that would be what we could do to help protect it. So
can you kind of back up the time machine? How does one find themselves living in the Boundary Waters for a year? I mean, that's a pretty daunting task, because there's clearly cold weather in the winter. There's a lot of logistics to work out. Someone's going to hear this and be like, and that's actually when I first found you guys, when you were in the process of living in the Boundary Waters, I believe. How did you get from who you were before to what's the backstory on that?
I'll try to sum it up as best I can, but
take as long as you need, because I feel like this is where people come from, is they're like, how the heck? I that kind of sounds cool, but there's no way I could live in the Boundary Waters. But it's a series of events, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess first you need to know a little more about our background.
Okay.
You know, had a lot of, I guess you could say, kind of learning experiences. You know, we didn't start from like, you know, not ever camping to saying, okay, we'll spend a year in the Boundary Waters. Mm-hmm. So with working as canoe guides and dog sledding guides, that gave us a lot of good practice, you could say, kind of getting used to knowing how to dress for winter in the Boundary Waters, and also kind of how to deal with those logistics of You know, like packing a canoe and portaging and all that mm-hmm. stuff. But the other part to it is, for many years, Dave and I have also worked for a nonprofit, an educational nonprofit that Dave started, where we basically go on human-powered expeditions and teach kids about the places that we're traveling through. And so we'll satellite terminal in order to be able to do regular updates on a website. So we could provide lots of content in the form of, you know, blogs that are basically like, you know, kind of guided reading exercises that have worksheets that go along with them. Oh, but we would also, you know, we would make it interactive, so we would pose questions to the kids about different sort of dilemmas or things that we're encountering, and have them kind of come up with solutions or make decisions about our route and stuff like that. So through that, and I should say that's called the Wilderness Classroom, we've gone on many like extended journeys. Yeah, so Dave just said a dozen. Do you want to describe anything more there?
So basically we started out, you know, just going on short trips with our families when we were mm-hmm. kids, you know, yeah. car, you know, long weekend overnights in the Boundary Waters. And then as we honed our skills, we developed, you know, we took longer and longer journeys. Sometimes people find this hard to believe, but actually the spending a year in the wilderness in some ways was actually easier than some of the other things that we had previously done. The big expedition that we did before spending a year in the wilderness was a 11,700 mile journey from basically Seattle, Washington up to the Arctic Ocean, across Canada to Lake Superior, out the Great Lakes, to the St. Lawrence Seaway, and then down the East Coast to Key West, Florida by canoe, kayak, and dog sled. That took us the better part of 3 years. And, you know, I mean, we had blizzards and minus 55 degrees and, you know, all sorts of craziness during that journey that really helped prepare us for spending a year in the wilderness. Not that there weren't challenges, but the skills that we had developed over many, many years. You know, Amy and I met in 2006 and we got married we met in 2005. We got married in 2010. And, you know, the last 13 years or something, we've probably spent more nights in a tent or living out of a canoe or a dog sled or a kayak than out of, you know, in a house or something, certainly in a house, because we never really live in a house, but it's just what we're used to. So being out in the wilderness is what feels natural to us. And I think that's why we decided that was the thing that we could sort of give to the campaign to save the Boundary Waters. You know, it was something we felt like we could do. And so we wanted to use those skills that we developed over time, and we really looked at it as, you know, 52 week-long trips in the Boundary Waters. And, you know, with some planning, anybody can take a week-long trip in the Boundary Waters. So why couldn't we just link 52 of them together and turn it into a year?
Yeah. This is going to sound like a really simple but, like, complex question, I guess. Why do all of that? Like, what is propelling you guys to go through all of that effort? I mean, and this isn't just like the Boundary Waters. Like, you just explained like a 3 year long experience that took a lot of effort, that a lot of people would be like, this is crazy. But there's something that keeps you guys going, and I'm curious what that is. Like, why not have the house on the hill, or why not, you know, why spend so many nights a year in a tent chasing down these wilderness areas and educating people on them? Have you figured out like why that is so important to you?
I think it's a variety of things. I think we just feel more alive when we're out in wild places and being challenged, and you know, the highs are higher and the lows are lower, but it's like when you're living in a climate controlled setting and you hop in your car and you put your dirty dishes in the dishwasher and you turn on a tap when you need water and you twist the thermostat when you want it a little colder or a little hotter, like it's comfortable, it's great, but there's something that you get when you're, you know, cold and wet and sleeping on the ground and haven't showered in weeks, and you're really pushing yourself. You know, sometimes that's hard, but then, you know, you see this amazing sunrise, or have you know, humpback whales surface next to your kayaks in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, or a herd of caribou run across a frozen lake in front of you, or you know, or sitting by a lake in the Boundary Waters listening to the call of loons echoing across the lake, and you can't hear or sense any signs of other humans, and it just distills life down into these very basic things, you know, food to eat, water to drink, you know, basic shelter, companionship, you know, these basic things are really what matter. And I think when we're in the wilderness, we're constantly reminded of those things, and everything else sort of sloughs away. And that can be a beautiful thing. And I think that's, in a lot of ways, that's what draws us to continue to sort of seek out wild places and also try to help other people sort of see the value in these places and encourage them to get outside and be in these wild natural places, because there's just nothing like it. I think it gives us so much, and we just really want other people to have that experience that we've been lucky enough to have.
Amy, is that kind of the same thing for you in terms of, like, you're kind of working for these, like, the payoff is so huge when you see these moments, when you have these moments?
Yeah, definitely. On a personal level, I think, you know, there's definitely wanderlust involved in our motivation. You know, we love studying maps and seeing where different waterways go. You know, for me, the kind of first exposure to that was paddling a kayak on Lake Superior near Grand Marais, Minnesota, and just thinking, like, wow, I wonder what's beyond that next point, you know, and wanting to see that, and wanting to experience it, and to see it in a kind of a slow and I guess it's almost, you know, you get to experience the place more intimately if you're traveling slowly through the environment, you know, you're a kayak or a canoe, or you're hiking, or you know, on cross country skis or whatever it is, you really get to know that place more than if you're driving past in a car, or riding a train or a plane or something like that.
So for you, it was there was a moment when you were like, yeah, this is it. Dave, I'm curious, do you recall a moment for yourself that you were like, it just clicked? And because Amy's talking about, like, what's around that corner? What's around, you know, what's over there? You guys are exploring. Like, you didn't just live in the Boundary Waters for a year in one spot. You were moving, and you're still moving, and you're exploring. Do you remember a moment in your life when you were like, yeah, I'm going to need to find out more?
You know, I think I always, like, I always wanted to be a marine biologist and be like Jacques Cousteau, like a, you know, explorer. That was sort of my thing. But I remember my first canoe trip, the first time I visited the Boundary Waters. I think it was the summer between 6th and 7th grade. And we paddled about a mile from the parking lot, you know, into the wilderness. And then we portaged this like flat straight portage that was a couple hundred yards long to the next lake. And then we paddled another mile or so and we set up camp and spent 3 or 4 nights there and, you know, listened to loons and we caught fish and we swam in the, you know, this beautiful clear lake. And we thought we heard wolves howling, but actually I think they were just loons. But, you know, I felt like I was just in the middle of nowhere, you know, like just so wild, like nothing I'd ever experienced before. And then when we went back to the outfitter where we rented our canoe and our gear, and I just remember looking at the wall, they had this huge map with hundreds and hundreds of lakes. It didn't even show the whole wilderness area, but it showed probably half of it. And I just remember staring at that wall and all these lakes and portage trails all laid out and literally hundreds and hundreds of miles of canoe trails and just thinking, wow, like it just scratched the surface, you know, and it's like I had to come back. I had to start traveling further into the wilderness and just, I was hooked immediately.
How far can you go into the boundary waters? Like, what is the most remote that you can be?
There's actually another park on the Canadian side. So that's sort of like mirror image called the Quetico Provincial Park. And it's another million plus acres of roadless wilderness. So it's pretty vast. I mean, if you paddled through the boundary waters and then probably traveled another 20 or 30 miles north into Canada, right into the middle of this, you know, wilderness area on both sides of the border, you know, that would probably be where you'd be the furthest from any road or anything like that. And, you know, probably the average person who would take maybe 5 or 6 days of continuous travel to get to that point. So, you know, it's a big area. It's a vast area.
You know, I've spoken, anyone that I've mentioned, sorry, let me rephrase, anyone that I've spoken to that has experienced the boundary waters, it's like meeting a thru-hiker that hiked the PCT or the AT or the CDT. They're like, yeah, it's amazing. And you won't hear like a negative word about it. And it's like this, it's like they're drawn to it. That place has got, to, I want to experience it one day because of how magnetic it is for a lot of people.
Yeah, it is, you know, it's, and I think it took us a while to really understand how special it was, and not just to the, you know, people locally in the Midwest, but across the country. And, you know, as we started delving deeper into this mining issue and talking to more people about it, we realized that it's like, there are people that come from, you know, California and Texas and New York and Florida and all over. Many of them come every year or every couple of years. It's like a pilgrimage that they make because, you know, they have wild places closer to where they live, but nothing like this. And so it really, it draws people from across the country. And I think anyone that loves the outdoors should come and check it out, because it really is like nothing you will find anywhere else.
Question about if people are interested in visiting the boundary waters. A lot of times, like I don't personally, I'm really fascinated with traveling via canoe or just, you know, via waterways, you know. I envision myself one day wanting to like, cool, I'm going to backpack with my canoe essentially. Right. Or whatever river going or lake going device I have, kayak or canoe. And I would love to just go and back and experience stuff like that. Are there like different levels of like difficulty with the boundary waters, or where would somebody start if they're like, cool, I'm going to go check out the boundary waters. I don't have a canoe, but I would imagine you can rent one somewhere at an outfitter. Is it something that you can easily kind of work your way into?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's really why it's our nation's most popular wilderness area. It's just so accessible. So If you've never canoed before, or even if you've never camped before, you can, you know, go and kind of start at square one at any number of canoe outfitters. So you can have a trip fully outfitted with all the gear and the food, and you just bring yourself and your clothes, basically, and have a guide kind of show you the ropes. Or if you're feeling like, okay, you know, I have some background knowledge on canoeing, I think I can do this on my own, you can enter. There are so many different entry points for the wilderness area, so you can enter on a fairly easy lake, and you could just paddle right to your campsite, you know, so you could do a trip essentially where you don't have any portages and you base camp and make it really easy. But then the cool thing about it is you can have this progression where, like, okay, maybe I did the base camp thing and didn't paddle very far from the entry point for my first trip and want to go a little farther the next one. And you try, you know, portaging a few lakes in, and, you know, you can get to the point where you spend a week or 2 weeks or a month or a year.
I was going to say, eventually you're finding yourself just living in the Boundary Waters.
Not really.
What was, yeah. Can you guys kind of talk about a year in the Boundary Waters, what that looked like? Maybe, I don't know, like the high level stuff, like, okay, cool, this is what our day was, this is what we did, and this is like a high point and a low point?
Sure. You know, so we didn't really have, you know, we didn't have like an itinerary. We didn't really plan out where we were going to go. We basically, what we did was we said that we would get resupplied every 2 weeks. And so we set a date and an entry point. There are over 80 entry points where you can enter the wilderness. And so we picked an entry point and we picked a date, basically at 2 week increments. And then we had a man named Levi, who was our expedition manager that works for the Campaign to Save the Boundary Waters. And he just put out sort of word, and all these people, we ended up having over 300 people volunteer and bring supplies in. And so we didn't have to be in a certain place at a certain time other than, yeah, we need to be in this general area, you know, 2 weeks from now, a month from now, 6 weeks from now. And so on a day-to-day level, really our routine was dictated by the weather. Oftentimes, if it was, you know, nice weather, we'd pack up camp and maybe we'd paddle and portage and for 5 to 8 hours and then set up camp in a new place. If the weather was really crummy, maybe we would we'd just say, oh, we're not going to travel today. We'd just stay at camp, and we would spend more time writing or photographing or you know, sort of working on documenting and sharing the experience. So our routine was really more dictated by the weather. People asked us, like, you know, how many days were you windbound, you know, because sometimes when it's windy, especially if you're on a big lake, there'll be big waves, and so you could be stuck and it'd be really hard to travel. And we were like, oh, we were never windbound, what are you talking about? And then we started thinking back about it, and it was just, there were certainly days where we would have been windbound, but we just didn't think about it that way because we didn't have a schedule, you know. It wasn't like we were out there for a week and we were trying to move from place to place on some sort of schedule. That just was not even in our minds at all. And so our routine was really set by the natural world, and we just sort of went where we wanted to go and stopped when we wanted to stop and ate when we got hungry.
And if the weather was crummy, we'd brew another pot of coffee.
Yeah.
Is that that kind of existence lifestyle, I don't know if that's a thing, existence, I'm going to call it existence lifestyle, where you're like, yeah, we're kind of just living, this is our backyard, this is our home, and we can either stay or we can go. Is that different than what you guys had done in the past?
It is, big time, yeah. So for all of our other journeys, we had a schedule. You know, it's like roughly, we had to make a certain number of miles every day in order to get to a certain point. You know, and that was oftentimes dictated by the seasons, that like, okay, if we're canoeing, we have to get somewhere before the lakes freeze, or if we're dog sledding, get somewhere before the lakes melt. And we had these goals that like, okay, we have to reach a certain point. And it took us a while to adjust to that, I think. Yeah. When we first went to the wilderness, we kind of, well, I must admit, the, you know, 48 hours leading up to our launch, they were pretty hectic. And so we were exhausted. So we did actually just relax and stayed in one campsite for two nights. But then after that, we were kind of like, okay, let's go. And, you know, maybe going, I don't know what, 15 miles a day or something like that. And then we realized that we could slow down. And it was important, I think, actually, to slow down, because, well, one, we were happier, you know, not trying to battle the elements if the weather was challenging. But also, it just made the experience that much richer. You know, the purpose of for us being out there was to share the place with people through the photos that we were taking and our social media posts. And so the more attention we paid to the little things, I think the better the experience was, not just for us, but for the people that were following along.
Yeah. How long did it take you? How long did it take you to finally kind of like just kind of let go and be like, yeah, actually, we don't have to be anywhere. This is where we need to be. We need to pay attention to the details, because this isn't going to last for the rest of our lives. Even though it's a year, it can go by really fast. So how long did it take you to finally realize and have that realization of like, ah, we can just live?
You know, I don't know about for you, Amy, but for me, you know, we entered on the fall equinox. And I think it was probably about 6 weeks or something, you know, early November, probably when I was really, it finally dawned on me that, yeah, it doesn't matter if we go 2 miles or 20 miles, you know, like we're just out here. We need to focus on, you know, watching wolves fishing and, you know, fish spawning and, you know, sunrises and, you know, all these things that were happening all around us. That was the more important thing, and just kept slowing down. And I think one of the things that really struck us was that, you know, we had spent long periods of time in the wilderness before, you know, having, you know, traveling for 6 weeks or 6 months at a time through very wild areas in northern Canada. But, you know, even then, typically once a month or something, we would stop in some little town for usually just a few hours to like pick up more supplies and things like that. But there was some interaction with the outside world, but we found that our senses were still becoming more sensitive and more heightened. Even after like 6, 7, 8 months in the wilderness, we were still, you know, smelling things we'd never smelled before, hearing things we never heard. It was really interesting to see that our senses were continuing to sharpen. I think we sort of thought after a month or two, maybe we would be like fully acclimatized to the wilderness and, you know, that would be it. But I think if we had spent another year in the wilderness, we would have just continued to hear and see and sense things that we hadn't sensed before, just because our bodies were still getting more and more used to being in the wilderness.
That's incredible. That's it blows my mind that you just said it took 6 weeks roughly to like kind of have a realization of, cool, yeah, let's do, I can relax. We're not going anywhere. This isn't ending anytime soon, and I can kind of explore. And then 8 months, your body's still adapting, and then your comment of, man, even after 2 years, you'd think you could probably still be, you know, adjusting to your environment. Does that kind of throw your mind through a bit of a loop in terms of what people are experiencing not in the wilderness and how disconnect or like the jumbled up mess that sometimes the city can give us, or that not being connected to the wilderness can kind of do to us?
Yes.
It had to have changed your entire perspective, because like you said, you guys have been out there before. You're not spring chickens. Like, you've been there. In 8 months in the Boundary Waters, you're now having new senses being queued up. That's incredible.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting to think too that kind of sensitivity or the heightened senses didn't really go away once we exited the wilderness. I mean, I think at this point in time, they probably are sort of dulled by our time in civilization, but it was jarring for us to go from sleeping outside in a tent every night to trying to fall asleep inside, or being around lots of people or being in traffic. I think it was most noticeable for us in terms of sleeping. We kind of thought like, oh, wow, we're in the lap of luxury, you know, sleeping inside of a house finally after a whole year. And it was, you know, kind of great to take a shower and then lie down in a bed. But the truth of the matter was, we were totally weirded out by it. And it took us weeks to get used to sleeping inside again. And I think the big thing was, we were separated from just sort of those natural ambient sounds. So like water lapping on shore, the wind in the trees. You know, when we came out of the wilderness, it was cold outside, and so couldn't just open the window to try and get some of that back again. So that was really strange for us, and kind of brought me in touch with like, wow, there are people that are completely missing all that, you know?
Yeah. Well, you hear long distance hikers, I've heard them talk about how they get home after 6 months on the trail and they're like, I can't sleep in my bed. I have to sleep on the floor. They have a hard time adjusting. I mean, I hiked, you know, the PCT. I had an experience kind of like that. I know what people are talking about, but for some people, it really hits them hard and they're like, this is uncomfortable for me.
Right. Yeah.
Well, it makes sense. It would make sense why you guys are so passionate about the Boundary Waters after having experienced what you just discussed. So on that note, we touched on it a little bit already, but can we kind of deep dive the threat that this mine poses to the Boundary Waters in a little more detail?
Sure. Yeah, so there's actually a lot of mining in northern Minnesota, iron ore mining, like taconite mining. But there's never been a copper mine built in the area. And copper mining and iron ore mining are sort of like comparing apples and oranges. They're very different. And the main problem is that here we have this extremely water-rich place. So the Boundary Waters Canary Wilderness is part of the Superior National Forest. The Superior National Forest is about 3 million acres, roughly 2% of all of our national forests in the whole country. But this 2% of the national forest contains over 20%, one-fifth of all the fresh water in all of our national forests. So it's a very water-rich place. Just this whole maze of lakes and rivers. Like if you look at a picture of it from the air, I mean, it literally looks like it's half land and half water. And so the idea is that they want to put a copper mine basically right in the middle of this maze of lakes and rivers. And the copper and nickel and gold and other metals that are found in very small amounts are mixed in with something called sulfide. And so about 0.6% of what they would pull out of the ground would be copper, nickel, and other metals that we want. The other, you know, 99.3% is waste rock. And in order for them to pull that copper out, they have to crush large amounts, like hundreds of thousands of tons of this waste rock has to get crushed into like a talcum powder like form. And along with the copper and other minerals that we want, there is small amounts of sulfide. And when sulfide is exposed to air and water, it produces sulfuric acid, battery acid, and that ends up leaching all sorts of heavy metals and other toxins into the environment. So if you think about having, you know, 100 football fields piled 400 feet high in pulverized waste rock, and all of that has to be separated from water and air indefinitely, or this chemical reaction will happen where sulfuric acid is formed and it will, you know, leach all these toxins into the environment. I mean, that's basically what we're looking at. And, you know, a mine of this type has never been built anywhere in the world without causing significant ground or surface water pollution because of this acid mine drainage, this sulfuric acid, which forms when the sulfide is exposed to air and water. So, you know, to take this very toxic type of mining and then put it on the edge of our nation's most popular wilderness area that also happens to be this, you know, extremely water-rich environment is sort of a disaster waiting to happen. And so that's why we've been working so hard to try and stop it, because, you know, it really would have a devastating impact on the lakes, rivers, and streams that are really at the heart of this wilderness area.
This might sound like a really weird question, but how in the world does something like this even get proposed?
It's a good question. So back in the 60s, you know, some people were prospecting and they found that there were these deposits, these mineral deposits. So this was before the Wilderness Act. It was before the Clean Water Act. It was, you know, a long, long time ago, very different time. And so these mineral leases were granted at that time. And no mine was ever built. And
I'd just like to note, the leases were granted to a different company that no longer exists today.
Okay.
The mineral leases have changed hands.
Yes, multiple times. So those were 20-year leases, and they expired, and then they were renewed, and they expired, and they were renewed multiple times. And in 2012, at this point, their mineral prices had gone up, and so there was some prospecting going on, and they wanted to renew these leases because they were about to expire. And this sort of fledgling local group of people realized, whoa, wait a second, what's going on here? And they petitioned the federal government and said, hey, you don't have to renew these leases. And that set this whole ball into motion, which caused us to spend a year in the wilderness. And in December of 2016, in March of 2016, the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management and the federal government determined that they did not have to renew the leases, that it was optional. And then in December of 2016, the Forest Service
and the Bureau of Land Management decided that they would withdraw the mineral leases for they would not renew these expired leases held by this Chilean mining company, and they would put a ban on mining in the watershed of the Boundary Waters in place for 2 years to do a comprehensive scientific review, with the suggestion that at the end of the review, the Bureau of Land Management withdraw the mineral leases for 20 years because of the extreme threats that were posed by mining right on the edge of the Boundary Waters. And so that was great. That was totally what we wanted. But then when the Trump administration came into power, basically they have just rolled all of that back. They canceled the 2-year scientific study about a month before it was going to be completed, without releasing any information to the public about what they found in the study. And they just said, nope, we're gonna open this up to mining. And so now we have right before Christmas, they announced that they were going to renew these leases to this Chilean mining company to allow them to open a mine, or, you know, start working towards opening a mine. And they gave a 30-day comment period. So right now we're in the middle of this 30-day comment period, and we have until January 20th to gather as many comments as we can in support of protecting the Boundary Waters from and not allowing, you know, this mine to be built. So this is really a critical time, and you can go to savetheboundarywaters.org to sign the petition and take action to help protect the Boundary Waters, because this is really like going against all science. It doesn't make any sense at all, but excuse me. You know, this is really going against, you know, science and the best judgment, but that's what we're up against right now. And so this is really an important time to make our voices heard.
What is Canada doing? Because they're going to be impacted by this, right? Like their side of the Boundary Waters?
Yeah, that's true. The water doesn't know any boundaries. And actually the U.S.-Canadian border in this place, like in the Boundary Waters, the border runs right down the middle of these lakes and rivers. So the north side is in Canada, the south side's in the U.S. And that's all directly downstream from the proposed mine site. And so there's a joint commission that has people from the U.S. and Canada on it that deal with sort of shared water issues. And this is something that the whole border has. There are different sort of regions, and this district is the Rainy River District. So they're aware of it, and they have sort of requested that the government look at, you know, the impacts that the mine would have on Canada, you know, because the water does flow up to the Canadian border. But so far, you know, I think those requests are sort of caught in the bureaucratic cogs, and you know, so far Canada hasn't really come out with any specific stance or anything like that. So I think realistically this is going to be decided by the U.S. federal government because the mines are being proposed in the U.S. and so it could impact Canada certainly if the mines were built, but I don't foresee that Canadian intervention is going to, you know, either stop the mine from being built or cause it to be built. I think it's going to be made at the federal level in DC.
I have a really hard time understanding how someone in control of something like this, like, what is in their brain? And I don't feel like you guys are being like any, I don't get this feeling like you're overselling it or anything like that. Like, it's fairly common sense. If you've watched any sort of like Planet Earth or Discovery Channel and you or you look up mining, it's not exactly like, especially near water sources, it's just not a super clean process. I don't think you really need to be a biologist to figure that out. And then to think that the boundary waters are what they are, super clean water. And then if you're just going to drop a mine in the middle of that thing, or even nearby it for that matter, it just doesn't seem like it should be that difficult to figure out that it will be impacted in a negative way. I mean, we're not crazy here. But what do you think the other side of the coin is? Like, I often wonder if you could get that one person in a room and be like, bro, what are you thinking? Like, why are you doing this? Why do you not see this? And if you do, what are you thinking? Like, what in the world is going on here?
Yeah, I think there are a variety of arguments. Sort of on a local level, the community is divided because some people really want the mine because they envision it being like a real boost to the local economy to produce a lot of jobs and high paying jobs for people that are, you know, working in the mine, driving, you know, ore trucks and, you know, all that stuff related to the mining. And there could be some truth to that, but the reality is that mining is becoming very automated. So it's likely that by the time this mine is built, the number of jobs, you know, there would be a lot of jobs that would be produced in the short term in construction of the mine. But after the mine is built, it most likely would not require that many people to run it because of automation. And many of those jobs would also be very highly skilled. And so it's not clear that, a lot of those people probably would come in from other places to fill those jobs. So it wouldn't necessarily be a lot of jobs for the local people. Two economists from Harvard actually released an economic study where they looked at, like, I think about 70 different economic models, and in all but two of the models that they ran, the economy in both the short term and the long term would be better if a mine is not built, because the local economy is very highly dependent on both tourism, all these hundreds of thousands of people that are coming to the area to visit the boundary waters, to fish, to hunt, to camp and vacation. And then also all these people that are living in the area that are working remotely as like college professors or, doing all sorts of different things. And they choose to live in the region because of the natural spaces. And so if that was ruined, those people would leave and could have a dramatic negative impact on the economy. So that's one argument is the economic benefits, but I don't think that's a very strong argument. Other arguments are that we need the minerals, which is true. We definitely do need the minerals. But I think when I think about it, I think if as a country or as a world, if we can't decide that, we certainly do need mines, we need minerals. But if we can't say, there are certain places that we really should not destroy to build a mine. Most places where copper mines are currently being built or running, operating in the U.S. at least, are in very arid regions of the West, and they still produce significant pollution there. But if a mine in Arizona is causing a lot of problems, how is that? I mean, you go to a really water-rich place like northern Minnesota, and you're opening up a whole new can of worms. So, I think that's my feeling, is that there are some places that are just too precious to risk. And I think, the Boundary Waters and also the Pebble Mine in Alaska, I think, are two examples of places that, you know, these are not places that we should put at risk by building a mine.
Yeah. Well, it just makes you wonder, you know, if someone were to plop a mine or a rock quarry in the middle of Yosemite Valley, people would lose their minds.
Right, right. And there was actually a similar, there was this Yellowstone actually had a similar, and also the Grand Canyon, both had mineral, you know, mining proposals within the watersheds of the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone. And those are other examples of where the federal government in the end said, you know what, this isn't the right place. You know, we shouldn't be doing this on the edge of the Grand Canyon or you know, right by Yellowstone, because these are iconic places like the Boundary Waters are, and it's just not worth the risk. I think those types of examples are really what we're talking about here. It's like, you know, a Yellowstone, a Yosemite, you know, the Redwoods, these are places that are just iconic, and they're worth far more to the country collectively if we keep them pristine than if we are to, you know, be short-sighted and try to make a quick buck by, you know, building a mine or something similar.
Yeah, and you're not going to get it back. Like, you can't just cover up the mine. Like, you can't just like do it and then undo it. I would imagine that's very difficult to do.
No.
Right, we're talking like hundreds of years of acid mine drainage.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what show I was watching. Maybe I was talking to someone about this, but someone mentioned somewhere, someone was mentioning, like, if you look at a map of the United States and you, before, you know, it was explored and whatnot, and it was just in its natural state, and then you compare that to it, to what it is now, and you think of the wilderness areas that are left. That's kind of like heart dropping, right? And you can't, they're not making more wilderness areas.
No.
They're not, it's not a machine. Forests, unless it's like an apocalyptic moment, maybe in like hundreds of thousands of years, it'll be back. But they're not making more wilderness areas. They're making more neighborhoods and roads and mines and these things. So it just makes me like, I don't think it's super hippie and like crazy to say, hey, let's reserve these places. Let's like mess up the places we've already messed up if you're going to do anything, right? Like, I mean, that's not the right approach either. But my point is, like, we're not making more wilderness areas. We might as well. They're already designated. Let's do them a solid by protecting them.
The best we can. Yeah, I think we're on the same page with you there.
So if people want to go, I'll put the links in the description. And after this call, you guys can shoot me all of the web addresses that you've mentioned. Sure. So the best way for someone, if they hear this and they're like, I would like to contribute to helping this not happen. The best way to do that would be
to go to savetheboundarywaters.org, or, you know, you can just Save the Boundary Waters on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter. And there are links to, you know, taking action. So you can contact your representatives. You can make a donation. You can sign the petition. There's a lot of ways that you can help. So that's definitely a really important first step.
Okay. Man, this has been an enlightening conversation, and I greatly appreciate it because, man, this is exactly what I was hoping for when you guys agreed to come on and chat with me for an hour.
Oh yeah, I'm so glad that we could do it. And one other thing I wanted to mention is that after we spent a year in the wilderness, we wrote a book called Year. Yeah. And so if you want to sort of get more details about what it was like to be out there for a year, definitely check that out. Even if you don't like to read, there's over 100 full color photos. It's like half pictures and half text. We've had a lot of people come up to us. They're like, it's been like a decade since I've read a book. I loved your book, you know? Like, so don't be intimidated if you hear the word book and you're like, I don't know, I'm more of a podcaster, you know, but it's still worth it. Cause there's a lot of pictures.
So on that note, you guys have gone off. I mean, how long ago, what year was it when you guys did the Boundary Waters?
It was September of 2015 to September of 2016.
Okay, so that's quite a while ago. It's almost 2019 when we're recording this. I wanted to go into like what you guys real quick. Like, what have you guys been up to since, and how can people reach you if they like what you guys are about?
Well, probably the easiest way to reach us is just on social media. Freeman Explore on Instagram or Facebook. And I don't know, after the book came out, we did a book tour, and then we did a book tour for the Boundary Waters, where we bicycled from the Boundary Waters to Washington, D.C., towing a canoe that people signed, like, behind our bicycles, and we did over 40 presentations along the way, and, you know, book signings and just sort of awareness raising, and then, you know, just guiding canoe trips and dog sleighing trips. And now we've been sailing for the last like 5 or 6 months, and we're writing another book about the 3-year, 11,700 mile trip we did across North America. That was between 2010 and 2013. So we're finally getting around to writing a book about that. So that's sort of what's freed us up to sort of take off on our sailboat, is because we're, you know, sort of in the middle of this writing project. And we're still very active with the Campaign to Save the Boundary Waters and working really hard on that issue. But we're just sort of taking a little bit of a breather, I guess, from the day-to-day operations of that.
Yeah. Well, man, after this conversation, I'm just like even more enamored with the Boundary Waters and what you guys are up to. Cause I have to make it out there at some point.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're, you know, I would say for people that are experienced, like backpackers or, you know, backcountry travelers, you know, you can pack your own food, you know, all the gear that you use backpacking will work fine. And you can just rent a canoe from, you know, one of a 100 outfitters. They'll set you up with a canoe, set you up with maps, help you reserve your permits, and send you on your way. And, you know, I think some environments are awesome for backpacking, and some, you know, maybe a boat makes more sense. But if you like backpacking, you know, a canoe trip in the Boundary Waters is going to be right up your alley.
Yeah. Okay. So the last, I usually like to end asking people what their advice is for new backcountry travelers, but I feel like I should probably ask you guys if you feel like you were born in the wrong century with all the explorations that you guys do, like these 11,000 miles. I feel like you guys are like a page out of like Lewis and Clark journals or something.
Well, the thing is, if we were born in a different century, we wouldn't have the means to share the adventures like we have,
right.
You know, internet and blogging and social media and a satellite terminal and all of that. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a weird combination of, you know, being removed from kind of most of the everyday technology, but then we still take technology with us when we travel. So I'm kind of glad that we were born in this century.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I agree, but I do find myself sometimes when we're traveling through, well, any place really, just sometimes thinking like, wow, you know, what would this have been like 300 years ago? Or, you know, just, you know, like, places like the East Coast, you know, I mean, the East Coast is like super populated now, but if you had gone there 500 years ago, what would you have found? And I think I think I could have enjoyed living a few hundred years ago, but there's a lot of great things about right now, you know, so try not to think about that too much.
Right. Well, it's so funny. I've always felt like, I'm like, man, I nerd out on Lewis and Clark. Like, I'm a huge nerd for Lewis and Clark. I'll read their original journals, the whole nine yards, and it's like an obsession of mine. And I read their stories and I'm like, or their words, and sometimes I'm like, man. And then I live in the Pacific Northwest where they came through, and I'll go by these historic sites, or I'll just think about as I'm driving through, and I'm like, man, what did it look like, you know, before all of this other stuff happened? And then it makes me wonder, was I born in the wrong spot or the wrong time? But then I'm like, but no, I get to learn about all this stuff now. Whereas before, probably maybe I wouldn't have heard about something.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing that is interesting is that, you know, for Lewis and Clark, and really almost all explorers up until at least like the last 100 years, and probably even more recently than that, like a huge part of the exploration was really like to bring humans and to sort of conquer these places, right? I mean, they're trying to figure out how they can like push settlements further west, or, you know, develop trade routes, and, you know, so, you know, now we go to these wild places to really try to help people appreciate them and conserve the remaining islands of wilderness that we have, where at that time in exploration, it was like, it was almost the opposite in a lot of ways. Not that what Lewis and Clark did was bad, but just that the humans were in such a different place then. I don't think they saw that, you know, the vast herds of buffalo were going to disappear, or that these vast wild places were going to disappear.
Yeah, I could spend a lot of time thinking about that stuff in my head. Man, guys, thank you so much for coming on. This has been such a pleasure and an honor having you guys on here. Your journey being like so long ago, now I'm like, man, I really have been following you guys for a while.
Well, it's our pleasure. Thanks for talking with us.
All right, that is it for episode 61. Thank you so much for joining me. And if you're interested in supporting Dave and Amy or finding out more about them, you can follow one of the links in the description. There's a bunch down there you can click on and explore what they're up to, and also take action in saving the boundary waters as well. If you're headed out this weekend or weekday or whatever it is you're doing, be safe, enjoy the backcountry, and we will see you next time on another episode of the Byland Podcast.